Sarah, along with a number of other academics and CPAs, are part of a movement that advocates full cost accounting, FCA, sometimes referred to as true cost accounting, TCA. Such approaches require the inclusion of information about both costs and benefits for each good and service, as well as possible alternatives, before a decision is made as to whether to produce and market it. Charges for these should include 1. All visible costs, not simply the immediate cash outlays. 2. Hidden costs, such as those incurred in the Ecuadorian Amazon. 3. Overhead and indirect costs, including research and development, public relations, management salaries, and bonuses. 4. Past and future costs, for example, feeding the families of workers who died from asphyxiation in a Congo mine so the world could have cheap coltan for cell phones and computers, and providing for people who will need health care because of horrible working conditions in an Indonesian sweatshop. 5. Life cycle costs, valuation of the environmental and social impacts of a given product or service necessitated by its existence and its disposal. The irony is that if these costs were included, the entire world would be better off. Under FCA, the goods and services provided in the most socially and environmentally responsible manner would undoubtedly also be the least expensive. In a true free market economy, consumers would pay a premium for products that strain the economy and society. The price would include costs for correcting the damage. Those goods and services that are inherently clean would also be the cheapest. Many corporations pay lip service to the idea of the triple bottom line, environmental, social, and economic, and some are actually introducing practices that move toward FCA. The latter reinforce the contention that such costs can be measured. Among those organizations making such an effort, the following were mentioned at the table that night during my meeting with the students in Wisconsin. The state of Florida claims to use a version of full cost accounting for its solid waste management programs. The urban ecology and industrial ecology approaches to architecture and regional planning stress the importance of treating the built environment as an ecosystem and of minimizing wastes. The natural step is one of several nonprofits that has worked with hundreds of businesses to help them establish accounting procedures that include life cycle costs. Interface Carpet Company is perhaps the most famous case of how things can be changed in a big corporation. Interface began operating in 1973 as a standard floor coverings manufacturer. In the mid-1990s, its chairman and CEO, Ray Anderson, experienced what he has described as an epiphany. As a result, he shifted the company's strategy toward industrial practices with a focus on sustainability without sacrificing our business goals. Anderson's book, Mid-Course Correction, discussed his own awakening to environmental concerns and presented a model for alternatives to wasteful management. It became a standard text for students and executives interested in new approaches. Interface's website states, "Business and industrialism developed in a different world from the one we live in today. Fewer people, less material well-being, plentiful natural resources. What emerged was a highly productive take, make, and waste system that assumed infinite resources with little or no thought given to its impact. Today, that system no longer enhances our prosperity. Instead, it is endangering it." When Interface saw itself as part of this system and the collective problem, we began a journey in a different direction, towards sustainability. Our journey has been incredibly good for the business of Interface. As our founder and chairman and the leader of the Interface journey towards sustainability, Ray Anderson, has said, "Costs are down, not up, dispelling a myth and exposing the false choice between the economy and the environment. Products are the best they have ever been because sustainable design has provided an unexpected wellspring of innovation. people are galvanized around a shared higher purpose. Better people are applying, the best people are staying and working with a purpose. The goodwill in the marketplace generated by our focus on sustainability far exceeds that which any amount of advertising or marketing expenditure could have generated. This company believes it has found a better way to a bigger and more legitimate profit, a better business model. As consumers, we have grown accustomed to telling corporations, give us the best tennis shoes possible at the cheapest price. We'll turn a blind eye to the sweatshop workers who are leading miserable lives, dying young and leaving starving children behind. Sell us inexpensive petroleum for our cars. We'll look the other way when we see photos of polluted rivers and devastated forests and deserts. The current economic crises reflect our unwillingness to pay full price as we go. It is as though we have been, and continue to be, shopping at a huge discount mall. We purchase everything for half its price. Unfortunately, our children and their children will not only have to pay full price for their merchandise, they will also have to ante up the parts we avoided with interest. One man who understands the dilemma facing our progeny only too well has been accused by the CIA of being a terrorist. He is, in fact, a visionary, a revolutionary who stood shoulder to shoulder with gun-wielding soldiers in the mountains of Central America. He is also a Catholic priest. Today, he occupies one of the most influential seats in the world. Chapter 11. Double Standards. Father Miguel Descoto Brockman showed me around his home outside Managua, Nicaragua. As we chatted about the indigenous artists whose paintings adorned his walls, it seemed impossible that this humble, compassionate man had been vilified by the Pope, sloshed through Central American jungles, ministering to guerrilla fighters, served as a cabinet member in Daniel Ortega's government, and now was about to assume the presidency of the world's most powerful multinational political body. The Catholic news agency, CNA, reported, June 6, 2008, 12:53 p.m., CNA. Suspended priest and former Sandinista leader Miguel Descoto Brockman has been elected to lead the next UN General Assembly beginning in September of this year. Descoto has been a Maryknoll priest since 1961, and in 1975, he became involved with the Sandinista movement in Nicaragua, eventually becoming the country's Minister of Foreign Relations, a post he held until 1990. He was suspended by the Vatican in the 1980s, together with two other priests involved in the Sandinista revolution, Ernesto and Fernando Cardenal. During a visit to Central America, Pope John Paul II publicly reprimanded him for his political activities. When Father Miguel, a fan of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, learned that I was visiting Nicaragua, he invited me to join him for breakfast. After that quick tour of his home, we talked about the fact that the United States and many of the existing international institutions often preach one thing and practice the exact opposite. The hypocrisy of the United States and the development banks is incredible, he said as we sat down in his dining room. Double standards, a case of do as I say, not as I do. We both knew that the U.S. Treasury and State Departments, in collaboration with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, purport to help third world countries pull out of recessions. However, they actually accomplish the reverse. It's intentional, he said. By driving countries deeper into crisis, those institutions cultivate circumstances that make the countries more vulnerable to corporate exploitation. What everyone missed along the line is that those steps also destabilized the global economy. A brief assessment of the economic team President Obama assembled tells the story. Timothy Geithner, former chairman of the New York branch of the Federal Reserve and Obama's Treasury Secretary. Larry Summers, ex-chief economist for the World Bank, Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, and the new director of the White House's National Economic Council, and Paul Volcker, retired Federal Reserve Chairman and now a top economic advisor to Obama, were some of the key architects of the double standard policies forced on developing countries years ago. When those nations experienced economic problems and were unable to make their loan payments, they were forced to accept structural adjustment programs, SAPs, that mandated that client countries drastically reduce government spending, raise interest rates, often to 30% or higher, privatize sectors of their economies, and sell national assets to multinational corporations. SAPs have been severely condemned by political and social scientists around the world because they, one, threaten national sovereignty and undermine the democratic process by transferring control to foreigners. Two, benefit the largest donors, especially the United States, European Union, Canada, and Japan, whose corporations end up owning the privatized sectors and whose financial institutions receive high interest rate payments. Three, privatize resources that had been in the public domain. Four, encourage foreign corporations to exploit workers and corrupt local officials as they lobby for lax environmental and labor regulations and tax loopholes. Five, discourage agriculture and land reform, thereby protecting aristocracies and facilitating the growth of slums and poverty. Six, increase the use of fertilizers and pesticides that damage the environment and make farmers dependent on foreign chemical companies. Seven, force cutbacks on health, education, and other social services by diverting money to interest payments. Eight, disenfranchise women who dominate workforces in the education, health, and other social services. And nine, cause the abandonment of women and children as rural men migrate to cities and other countries. However, the most important criticism is that they do not work. Or, restated, SAPs do not help the countries pull out of recessions. In fact, they drive them deeper into crisis. The proof? Geithner, Summers, Volcker and friends, Obama's team, are urging the United States to adopt solutions to our recession that are completely counter to those imposed on the Third World. Huge national spending programs, increased debt, reduced interest rates, bailouts, and the antithesis of privatization, government ownership of banks, automobile manufacturers, and other businesses. I pointed toward a painting on Father Miguel's wall where a spotted jaguar peered out from behind a wall of jungle foliage. "This double standard goes back a long time," I observed. "It's as though I told you that the best way to avoid attack by a jaguar is to quietly walk up to it and touch its nose. But when I find myself in that predicament, I make lots of noise, clap my hands and shout, and slowly back away." "Right," he pondered the painting. "Exactly. The double standard. Or," he frowned, "you tell the world that you will never negotiate with the Muslim terrorists who overthrew the Shah of Iran, when in fact you're striking deals to provide them with weapons." He laid a hand on my shoulder. "You know what I mean. The Iran-Contra scandal." "Exactly." He touched the jaguar's nose with his finger. "You know, double standards always come back to haunt those behind them." He grinned. "We priests have first-hand knowledge about all that." The negative impact of SAPs were clearly defined in a letter written to the president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, by the Development Group for Alternative Policies on April 16, 2004. It followed an exhaustive study known as the Structural Adjustment Participatory Review Initiative, SAPRI, begun in 1996, that involved thousands of organizations in many countries and included reports co-authored by the bank. The letter was signed by the members of the group's steering committee. They represented Argentina, Norway, Dominica, Zimbabwe, Canada, Bangladesh, Ghana, Hungary, Philippines, United States, and Europe. It began, Dear Mr. Wolfenson, we are writing to express our frustration and anger at the institution's continued imposition of these policies on the countries of the South and Eastern Europe in the face of clear evidence of their destructive nature and impact. Over the past decade, far from reducing poverty, adjustment programs have resulted in increased poverty and economic inequality, as well as numerous economic crises. The contribution of those numerous economic crises to today's global meltdown is immeasurable. Ecuador is only one of several nations that has defaulted on debt payments. More are threatening to follow. Furthermore, the erosion of purchasing power in countries that agreed to SAPs drastically reduced world markets for consumer goods. Privatization led to the squandering of natural resources and escalating prices for petroleum and other commodities. The knowledge that Washington and its allied financial institutions knowingly undermined so many sovereign nations has had severe long-term negative impacts on the United States' standing in the world. The message that our strategies are directed at exploiting rather than assisting countries has caused a disturbing rift between those who provide the resources and those who consume them. This political divide, in turn, plays a role in further exacerbating the economic crises. Over coffee that morning, I told Father Miguel about a U.S. Army general who predicted the current economic disintegration as far back as the late 1970s. It was perhaps ironic that this military man was the new U.N. General Assembly's president's opposite in so many respects, and probably would have killed him had he been assigned to lead soldiers into the Nicaraguan mountains. Yet that general, too, had seen that a fundamental weakness was infecting the U.S. system. He envisaged its consequences 3 decades ago, and they worried him greatly. Chapter 12. Militarized Paper Economy. Chuck Noble was military to the bone. A West Point graduate with a master's degree in engineering from MIT, he had served as commanding general of the U.S. Army Engineer Command in Vietnam. After retiring, he joined Maine as a project manager. He enjoyed a meteoric rise at the company that would catapult him to the presidency, replacing Paul Priddy. Despite the fact that I had avoided the draft by joining the Peace Corps, General Noble took me under his wing. I have no doubt that he had familiarized himself with my record at Maine and concluded that I was a loyal EHM. A trim man and exceptionally fit for someone in, I presumed, his early 60s, he had traded his uniform for conservative dark suits. He continued to crop his hair military short, and in almost every way he reflected his West Point training, except for one thing. He sported black engineer's boots, like the ones favored by members of the Hell's Angels. Sometimes the boots were spit-polished, but usually they were smudged with dirt. They baffled me at first. They seemed totally out of character. After I got to know him, I realized that they were his way of setting himself apart. He was not a typical general. He was also a blood-and-guts engineer. During one of his first assignments as a Maine project manager, Noble oversaw construction of the massive Salto Grande hydroelectric facility being built near the Argentina-Uruguay border, an endeavor that would produce nearly 2,000 megawatts, create a vast lake, and flood a town of 22,000 inhabitants. At one point, he arranged for me to join him. On that trip to Argentina, I learned how much Chuck detested communists and socialists. He was bitter over our loss in Vietnam, blaming it on our inability to understand the communist mind and on what he called our weak hearts. He was determined to enlist Maine as a vehicle for spreading democracy, which in reality meant promoting private corporations. I learned something else from Chuck, the importance of producing goods and services that are needed by people. We walked through a Buenos Aires market together one afternoon, and he kept pointing at things he called junk. Then he stopped and faced me. "You know," he said, "I'm really concerned that all this junk is going to bring us down. We in the States are setting an example for the world. Our movies, television, and magazines promote a false view of reality. Here we are in Argentina, and it surrounds us." He turned in a slow circle. "This stuff is pure crap. Our PR guys market it to the world, but we don't even produce it. The Japanese do, or the Indonesians. We just create the ads." A few months after he completed the Salto Grande assignment and returned to the United States, he sent for me. I was working in Panama at the time. I received a telex from him requesting my presence at a meeting in the Army and Navy Club. I flew to Washington and checked into my room. Late in the afternoon, I joined him and two other retired generals, as well as a retired Navy admiral, for dinner. As we sat down, Chuck glanced at the others. "I know we're here to talk about the Diego Garcia military base and the debacle in the Seychelles," he said. "But first I want to get something off my chest." "Shoot," one of the generals said. "Well," Chuck continued, "it's about what we in this country are doing to ourselves. Ike was a great general, but as a president he coined that phrase military-industrial complex. It became a dirty word. Now, my friends, this country is losing its industrial base altogether. I'm afraid we're becoming a nation of paper pushers." "Lawyers," the general interjected. "And investment bankers," the admiral added. "Exactly." Chuck shook his head sadly. "I predict that before long, we won't be producing much of anything at all. Just shoving a bunch of paper around. God help us." Chuck made that prediction in 1979. Today, one can see that to a large extent he was correct. We have become a paper economy, vulnerable to the whims of lawyers and investment bankers. The trading of corporations through mergers and acquisitions, and the pushing of financial paper in the form of forwards, options, futures, swaps, and other derivatives are huge parts of our system. When the economy peaked just before the recession began in 2007, over 40% of U.S. profits were earned by the financial sector, although it turned out to be paper profits. The very nature of a derivative, a financial contract whose value depends on, is derived from, the value of something else. For example, a commodity, stock, home mortgage, market index, belies the trust conveyed by paper. Perhaps it is a sign of the times that today paper pushers seldom use paper. They do it all with the push of a button, electronically. Chuck's concerns about the manufacturing sector were prescient. Creating junk has brought our economy down. What Chuck, who was a Milton Friedman fan, did not understand was that our obsession with profit maximization was a large part of the problem. When you view the short-term bottom line as your measure of success, you set yourself up for calamity. You believe, for example, that converting GE from manufacturing to financial services is a laudable thing to do, or that buying low in Japan, or today in China, and selling high in Buenos Aires or Minneapolis is good for the balance of payments. It does not matter that you are marketing things nobody really needs, that you are encouraging China to buy into that trinket capitalism Professor Ashton referred to, as long as you do it at a profit, regardless of its implications for the future, and despite the possibility that in the process you may be undercutting the very foundations of our own economy. In an article published by USA Today in December 2002, entitled U.S. Manufacturing Jobs Fading Away Fast, the author, Barbara Hagenbaugh, pointed out, 50 years ago, a third of U.S. employees worked in factories making everything from clothing to lipstick to cars. Today, a little more than one-tenth of the nation's 131 million workers are employed by manufacturing firms. The decline in manufacturing jobs has swiftly accelerated since the beginning of 2000. Since then, more than 1.9 million factory jobs have been cut, about 10% of the sector's workforce. Another trend has also emerged, one that gives credence to that warning by Eisenhower that disturbed Chuck so much about a military-industrial complex. On January 6, 2004, the United Kingdom's Independent ran an article by Andrew Gumbel, "How the War Machine is Driving the U.S. Economy. Military Keynesianism might get Bush reelected, but it is starting to worry economists." It included the following. "The war has been a large part of the justification for the Bush administration to run ever-widening budget deficits. The result, according to economists, is a variant on Keynesianism that has particular appeal for Republicans. Instead of growing the government in general, pumping resources into public works, health care, and education, say, which would have an immediate knock-on effect on sorely needed job creation, the policy focuses on those areas that represent obvious conservative and business-friendly constituencies, which is to say, the military, and even more specifically, the military contractors that tend to be big contributors to Republican Party funds." The article went on to report that during the second quarter of 2003, about 60% of the 3.3% GDP growth rate in the United States was attributable to military spending, mostly handed out to Halliburton, Bechtel, and other private contractors. The Pentagon had, according to the author, awarded a $4 billion deal to Northrop Grumman to help develop a Star Wars missile defense program. Reading that article got me to thinking about all the other industries that live off companies like Northrop Grumman, Halliburton, and Bechtel. Investments of that magnitude have many spin-offs, generating downstream profits and profiteering for a multitude of subcontractors. Yet as far as I could determine, these companies were producing expendables. Theirs are not goods any of us really need. They have one objective: to kill and to become obsolete quickly. Such products are destroyed in warfare or outer space. Furthermore, there are not many spin-offs likely to arise from such technologies that would benefit the general population. The article pointedly moved away from references to Friedman and back to Keynes. Was this merely another attempt at deceiving the public into believing that the Republicans were rejecting the theories they had subscribed to ever since the 1980 election? Or were the Friedman advocates beginning to see a crack in their foundation? Despite all the money poured into the military sector, the United States spiraled further into recession in 2008 and 2009, and the manufacturing sector lost more and more jobs. On April 5, 2009, NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday aired the following exchange. Linda Wertheimer, host. "On Friday, the Labor Department released more grim news. Another 663,000 jobs disappeared last month. That sent the unemployment rate up to 8.5%. This recession has been especially hard on people who work in factories. Since the recession began in December 2007, 1.5 million manufacturing jobs have been lost. Here to talk to us about the state of manufacturing in this country is Marilyn G. Wax, NPR's senior business editor. First, tell us, is there a crisis in manufacturing employment?" Marilyn G. Wax. "Absolutely. Factory jobs have been disappearing at a furious rate. In the past decade, we've lost nearly 5 million manufacturing jobs, and last month alone, we lost another 161,000. The scary thing is, we know that there will be more job losses coming because the Obama administration is planning to cut spending for weapons programs. That's going to trigger the loss of thousands of jobs in defense-related industries in New England, especially." The articles quoted above say a great deal about the U.S. economy and the way we, the people, look at it. 1. Between 2000 and 2002, more than 1.9 million factory jobs were cut, about 10% of that sector's workforce. 2. The Bush administration had already begun to invest heavily in military contractors during that period. 3. From December 2007 to May 2009, while billions of dollars were doled out to military contractors, an additional 1.5 million manufacturing jobs were lost. 4. And yet NPR's senior business editor was worried that there would be a decrease of thousands more jobs because Obama was cutting back on weapons programs. What, we might well ask, does all this mean? How does it relate to Ike's predictions or to Chuck Noble's? To try to arrive at answers to these questions, it is helpful to analyze some of the data around defense spending. The Department of Defense, DOD, announced that the U.S. military budget for fiscal year 2009 was $515.4 billion. According to the DOD, this amounted to a nearly 74% increase over 2001. In June 2009, a study released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, concluded that the DOD had grossly underestimated its budget by almost $100 billion, and that the actual U.S. expenditures were $607 billion. Although both of these are staggering sums, roughly equal to the total military budgets of all the rest of the world combined, they are deceptive in their omissions, since they are only the Pentagon's share of the military budget, excluding the costs of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. The DOD's $515.4 billion budget, whether it is correct or off by 20%, covers the salaries, training, and health care of uniformed and civilian personnel, the maintenance of weapons and facilities, day-to-day operations, and purchases for new equipment. It does not take into account the billions of dollars spent for weapons research and development, work on nuclear warheads and reactors under the Department of Energy, defense-related activities at other agencies, including the CIA, NSA, FBI, and Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs and other mandated programs, mostly military retirement and health care, interest on debt incurred in past wars, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are largely funded through extra-budgetary supplements, or other expenses incurred by the military for past activities but not yet paid. When all the items in these unaccounted-for categories are added to the ones of the official military budget, the total exceeds $1 trillion, about twice the figure stated by the DOD. It is one more example of how politicians who claim to oppose big government, taxation, and government spending manage to funnel record amounts of government money away from health, education, and other people programs and into the pockets of military contractors. The United States accounts for about 50% of the world's total military spending, and yet the United States' share of the world's GDP is less than 23%. Of the other top spenders on military budgets, at least 12 are considered allies of the United States. The United States outspends Iran and North Korea by a ratio of 72 to 1. An enlightening revelation that places this in further perspective was made on May 12, 2009. Pentagon requests record $50 billion black budget. The publication Aviation Week reports that the Pentagon is requesting a record $50 billion for its secret black budget. This marks a 3% increase over last year's total. The Pentagon budget for secret operations is now larger than the entire military budget of Britain, France, or Japan. Such a huge secret allocation of money begs a serious question about democracy. How can a nation that prides itself on government of, for, and by the people justify hiding such a mammoth amount of the taxpayer funds from taxpayer scrutiny? During that same dinner meeting at the Army and Navy Club in 1979, Chuck Noble asked, "What do you think will happen to a nation that doesn't produce anything of real value?" If we look back at World War II, an event that, along with the New Deal, is attributed with bringing us out of the Great Depression, we see that things of real value were invented and manufactured during that time. Many of the ships, airplanes, and motor vehicles that were produced for the war ultimately were sold to private corporations or individuals. The jet engine went into commercial operation. Auto manufacturers utilized breakthroughs to produce better cars less expensively. So did farm equipment industries. Huge improvements were made in radio communications, vacuum tubes, radar, X-rays, and other technologies that opened up the mass media and computer ages. Synthetic rubber revolutionized not only tire manufacturing, but nearly every other facet of the industry as well, and led to the invention of nylon and a host of new materials. Frozen, processed, and fast foods took off in the marketplace. Penicillin was but the first of the miracle drugs that totally altered medical practices. Each one of these was a byproduct of the war, and each one was a stimulus to U.S. manufacturing, as well as to other sectors, including retail, services, banking, insurance, agriculture, and healthcare. World War II stimulated creativity and entrepreneurship. It provided an economic stimulus that endured for many years. It should not have been so difficult for us to ask ourselves and our leaders after 9/11 how AK-47s, ground-to-air missiles, and cluster bombs would accomplish anything similar. We might have foreseen what we know now, that they would drive us into a terrible recession without the saving grace of offering anything back in return. Chuck Noble pushed his chair back from the table when we finished dinner that night at the Army and Navy Club. He crossed one leg over the other and raised a dirty black engineer's boot until it nearly brushed against the white tablecloth. "Ever wonder why I wear these?" he asked. "We all know, Chuck," one of the generals replied, "to hide your ugly feet." Chuck joined the laughter. "Well, that is one reason. But beyond it..." He paused and shot glances around the table. "I like to think that way back in history, boots like these were invented by a military engineer. The army with the best boots won." He paused to lower his leg. "That engineer created a whole new industry. Before him, people used to make their own shoes, crude sandals and moccasins. Afterwards, well, that's progress. But it only works when the military invents things that everyone really needs." Part 2. The Solution. Chapter 13. Changing Capitalism's Goal. "Mr. Perkins, you're the most sophisticated spokesperson for corporate greenwashing the corporations could ever dream of." The man was standing near the back of the packed auditorium at Regis University in Denver, shaking his fist at me. He was getting a lot of attention, and he knew it. "We want to abolish corporations." The message was not new. "The system is broken. We can't fix it. Stop apologizing for capitalism. Tear it down. Start over." I peered at him across the heads of the audience. "Can I ask you, how old are you?" A long pause. "Let's just say the same generation as you. Do you really think you can get rid of corporations in your lifetime?" "I admit to the possibility of a better system, but I also do not believe that capitalism is going to fall anytime soon. Nor do I think it should. Capitalism has proven to be a tremendous tool for channeling creative minds into productive uses. I tell audiences that I have a 1.5-year-old grandson, and I want to live to see us manifest a better world for him. In its current form, capitalism, the mutant form we have embraced, has become dangerous. That gives us a reason to change it, to remake it, but not to abolish it. The new form will set more compassionate goals. Instead of maximizing profits regardless of the environmental and social costs, profits will be made within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. I think that a lot of the confusion I hear from people stems from a misunderstanding of the word itself. What is capitalism? Capitalism, economic system in which private individuals and business firms carry on the production and exchange of goods and services through a complex network of prices and markets. Encarta. Like every other definition I have read, This one does not indicate that capitalists must plunder resources and omit externalities from their accounting practices. Nor does it suggest that profit should be a sole motive. That the lack of regulation is a requirement, that people and countries must be burdened with debt, that the government should not provide essential services like water, electricity, and health insurance, or that the many must be exploited for the benefit of the few. A brief review of history demonstrates capitalism's flexibility and at the same time gives us reason to be optimistic about its effectiveness in dealing with the current crises. The roots of modern capitalism spring from the mercantilism of the 16th through 18th centuries, when trading companies from Europe sent ships across the globe to expand empires and purchase goods they could sell at a profit. Organizations like the British and Dutch East India Companies were granted monopolistic powers through letters of patent. They became extremely powerful, exercising the right to raise militaries, negotiate treaties, and even dictate laws. Rulers saw these companies as the means for financing exploration. They were driven by a belief in duty to country, the conversion of the heathen to Christianity, and the proliferation of their particular ideas of civilization. Corporate profits funded lofty goals. The Industrial Revolution challenged the foundations of mercantilism. Inspired by Adam Smith in the mid-18th century, it shifted from a conviction that the world's wealth was a constant and that one nation could increase its prosperity only at the expense of others, to a belief that additional prosperity could be created through the manufacturing process. Smith and his contemporaries expounded the virtues of a free market as the most efficient method for assuring that industrialization would maximize benefits. His classic book, The Wealth of Nations, emphasized that an invisible hand would guide free markets to produce the right amount and variety of goods and services. However, Smith also warned against unscrupulous business people and the dangers of monopolies. In his Theory of Moral Sentiments, he praised the virtues of compassion. Profits were intended to finance just societies that would provide basic needs to all. That was the theory. In actual practice, things were quite different. During the 19th century, the rise of factories and the mines that fed them raw materials marked the beginning of a form of human exploitation that is symbolized by images of women and children laboring for long hours under horrible conditions at boringly routine yet often dangerous jobs, while the owners lounged in mansions. Smith's invisible hand was replaced by Darwin's survival of the fittest. Although robber barons employed every conceivable ploy to demolish competitors, in the United States they subscribed to the pretentious notion that they were agents of manifest destiny, a doctrine that justified the conquest of nature and the endless expansion of American territory as divinely ordained. God ordered the destruction of Indians, forests, buffalo, and other species, the expansion of railroads and canals, the mining of minerals, the draining of swamps, the channeling of rivers, and the development of an economy that depended on the exploitation of labor and natural resources. The robber barons and their counterparts in Europe were simply carrying out God's will. Such abuses stimulated a new breed of philosophers. Claiming that capitalism was inherently flawed, Karl Marx and his followers advocated a classless socioeconomic structure based on common ownership of property and the state's control over the means of production. The struggle of communist societies to win a cold war against capitalism following World War II often turned hot. In the end, the costs of this conflict gave communism's strongest opponents, like Ronald Reagan, their greatest power. It ultimately contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The popularity of socialist ideas in the 1930s empowered labor to organize in the United States. Unions forced the factories and mines to improve working conditions, increase wages, and offer health insurance and retirement benefits. Economic historians often cite this as an example of capitalism's ability to adjust to changing attitudes. Although the captains of industry at first opposed union demands, even violently, in the end, the improved lot of workers and their ability to become consumers stimulated economic growth. By accepting some of the tenets espoused by socialist writers, artists, and organizers, the owners, as well as their workers, benefited. The expansion of the manufacturing and mining sectors required massive amounts of capital. Consequently, their owners became increasingly dependent on and affiliated with the financiers. Throughout the 20th century, the individuals who provided the money, the investment bankers and brokerage houses, gained increasing control. During the New Deal and World War II, the industrialists and financiers combined forces to help pull the world out of the Depression, win the war, and establish the United States as the preeminent geopolitical power. Entrepreneurs and executives were inspired by their wartime successes. The emerging technologies fired the imaginations of a new generation who saw opportunities to prosper by applying scientific breakthroughs to daily life. Most believed, as did Professor Ashton, that they had a fiduciary responsibility to their stockholders and the long-term efficacy of their businesses. They turned laboratory experiments into televisions, computers, and cell phones, new forms of food, more efficient appliances, and medicines. At the same time, emphasis was placed on steady, stable growth. However, once again, capitalism altered itself. The individuals who controlled Wall Street slowly replaced the captains of industry in the corporatocracy, and they subscribed to the notion that the goal of business was profit, plain and simple. With the emergence of the technology and information industries, it became clear that genius did not accomplish much without money. Companies like Apple, AOL, Amazon, and Google relied on a combination of brains and financing. Mergers, takeovers, and buyouts became the norm, always manipulated by Wall Street. Financial vehicles, paper transactions, replaced manufactured goods as the prime economic movers. Giant conglomerates run by mercenary executives unseated companies that for decades had been managed by CEOs raised in the school of fiduciary responsibility. Throughout its history, capitalism has evolved into many forms. Chameleon-like, it has adapted to changing environments. However, the current Wall Street model is unusual in the extreme. It rose to dominance after Carter lost the election to Reagan in 1980. For the first time in a history dating back more than 400 years, capitalism's goal was defined as the maximization of profits with no other motivating factors. Any attempts to rein in executives were viewed as attacks on progress. When I hear people like the man at the back of the Regis University auditorium condemn capitalism as broken and call for the abolition of corporations, I understand that they view capitalism in this narrow context. When I hear them demand a completely new system, I find myself contemplating the failures of the Soviet Union and North Korea. The solution to our problems is to fix the broken system, not discard it. Over the centuries, capitalism has been extremely successful at responding to the needs of the times. It has made unfertile lands productive, eradicated plagues, sent people to the moon, and resulted in untold numbers of breakthroughs in science, technology, medicine, engineering, and the arts. Today, it is essential to redefine the goal. Instead of maximizing profits regardless of social and environmental costs, the new goal could be stated as making profits within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. The adjustment is already underway. Starting more than a decade ago, corporate social responsibility, CSR, became a watchword in corporate boardrooms. Currently, every major company pays at least lip service to the idea of the triple bottom line, the importance of achieving social and environmental targets, as well as financial ones, and many actively seek to make it part of their culture. A wave is sweeping across the global business community. China provides a living case study. The entire country is a laboratory. Mao tried to do exactly what the man at Regis University suggested, abolish capitalism. It was a dismal failure. Post-Maoist China, on the other hand, embraced capitalism, or what Mao's successor, Deng Xiaoping, referred to as a market economy with socialist characteristics. This was a miraculous success. Today's China offers profound insights about ways to modify capitalism, as well as warnings about what not to do. Perhaps no group of people understands this better than the MBA students I hung out with in Shanghai while I was in the middle of writing this book. Chapter 14. China, a lesson in transformation. Several times during my EHM tenure in the 1970s, I stood on a hill in the New Territories outside Hong Kong and peered into China, a mysterious country I was not allowed to enter. Along with Cuba, North Vietnam, and North Korea, China was off-limits to U.S. citizens. It was locked behind a wall of secrecy. About all most of us knew was that the country was in shambles due to Mao's Cultural Revolution. I finally had the opportunity to visit China in June 2009. When my plane landed in Shanghai, I looked through the window at the profusion of jetliners from dozens of countries and thought about all the changes that had occurred since my EHM days. China's economy had soared by unprecedented average annual rates of more than 10% for a third of a century. Incredibly, it was now ranked as number two in the world in purchasing power parity, just behind the United States, and number three, after Japan, in nominal GDP. I had read the statistics, yet I was unprepared for the reality behind them. Entering the Shanghai airport was like walking off a plane into a huge glass and steel spaceship. Expansive, otherworldly. I stood there for a moment and glanced around, overwhelmed by the sheer size and magnificence of the place. Images of my first trip to Asia flashed before me. Indonesia, 1971, the year before Nixon opened up China. The United States was losing the Vietnam War, and we feared, as Claudine had emphasized, that the rest of the region would fall, like so many dominoes, to communist domination. After that trip, I made dozens more, producing reports to coerce the Jakarta government into accepting massive loans to build infrastructure projects. My forecasts of economic growth were works of fiction, intended to demonstrate that if Indonesia's leaders assumed debts that would bankrupt their nation, they could convince their people that the investments would generate glorious returns in economic growth. We all knew that it was a scam, that the ultimate intent was to burden Indonesia with so much debt that it would be forced to join our sphere of influence and not be seduced by China. No one in those days believed that any country could sustain double-digit economic growth for more than a couple of years, and under no circumstances for a decade. Soon after that, China accomplished the impossible. And then it did it again. And again. China's economy mushroomed by an estimated tenfold. In three decades, the most populous nation on the planet rose from the depths of poverty to become the symbol of what human determination and capitalism can accomplish. Exiting from immigration, I was met by a man with a sign that had my name printed on it. I had expected a burly security officer type, but he was the opposite, diminutive, shy, more like a bookworm or computer geek than a government agent. He led me outside, past the airport hotel, which resembled another intergalactic spaceship, and into a car. A Buick, designed for China. Then we were speeding down a 10-lane highway lined with billboards advertising L'Oreal, Avis, Ricoh, and Toyota. And trees. We in the United States seem determined to focus on China's problems. People constantly point out, for example, that its greenhouse gas levels recently surpassed ours, usually neglecting to mention that on a per capita basis, our emissions are 5 times greater than theirs. Driving toward my hotel in the modern Pudong district, I was certainly aware of the low-lying mist I assumed was smog, but I was most struck by something quite different, the profusion of trees. There were dozens of varieties of them, everywhere. Tall, short, deciduous, coniferous, some bursting with colors, red, pink, white, and yellow flowers. They covered a broad center strip that divided outgoing from incoming traffic, lined the sides of the highway, and stretched back as far as the eye could see. Many were tall. All seemed healthy, either naturally suited to the local conditions or pampered. Obviously planted, they were clustered in formations that brought to mind the formal gardens of Versailles. In addition to creating a most pleasant environment for mile upon mile, they performed another function, that of removing carbon dioxide from the air. It was my first inkling of China's commitment to cleaning up its environment. When I tried to discuss this with my driver, I discovered that his English was limited to the few words of greeting he had uttered at the airport. I made a note to ask someone else as soon as I had the opportunity. "Yes," replied Mandy Chang, an MBA student at the China-Europe International Business School. CEIBS had brought me to Shanghai to speak at their Being Globally Responsible conference, and she was my host that first evening at a restaurant near my hotel. "We are all very aware of the pollution our economic development has caused. We young people are especially determined to turn it around. Trees are one small part of the plan." During the conversation, I asked her how she explained the phenomenal economic growth her country had experienced. "I've puzzled over that a great deal," she answered. "All I can say is that we Chinese are very hard-working, and we have been motivated." She smiled broadly. "These are exciting times. Everyone my age, I know, is eager to move forward into the future. Like the title of our conference says, we must be globally responsible." China has a long history of trading and business. Fellow student Jess Zhang, no relation to Mandy, added over coffee the next morning. "We experienced a period of decline for far too long, but once the decision was made in the 1980s to get back on track, we had the resources to draw on and also the traditions." The West's development occurred for many, many years and included a variety of experiments, observed Joseph Yu, the conference's student organizer who was sitting next to Jess. China could skip a lot of mistakes that had already been made. It didn't have to go through the Industrial Revolution. It jumped right into the modern age. Although the majority of the MBA students at CEIBS are Chinese, roughly 40% come from the United States, Europe, Latin America, and other parts of Asia. Their school was ranked among the top 10 MBA programs in the world by the Financial Times in 2009, along with Wharton, Harvard, Columbia, and Stanford. The conference attracted an even more diverse group. There were Communist Party members and people from Taiwan who had been raised to believe that communism was a demonic force intent on spreading an Orwellian North Korean-style model across the planet. All of the participants I talked with had spent time after graduating from college in the business world prior to enrolling in MBA schools. Many had served private corporations and multinationals, but some had worked for the Chinese state-owned enterprises, SOEs, that are the foundation of the nation's economic resurgence. Like so many MBA students I talk with in the States, their ambitions include working toward a better world. A lot of the Chinese students I know who received Western educations are now returning to Asia, Joseph Yu told me during one of our many conversations. "We can act as bridges between West and East, helping to clear up misunderstandings and faulty perceptions. As the world shrinks and boundaries between nations blur, people like us with cross-cultural backgrounds have a special role. we've developed unique tools that can serve our planet and peace. The conference lasted 2 days. After that, the students showed me around Shanghai. It was an eye-opening experience. Intellectually, I understood that an economic miracle had struck this country, but the reality was more spectacular than I had imagined. The defining event was an after-dark cruise down the Huangpu River, Shanghai's shipping artery that divides the city into west and east, past and future. The former is symbolized by the Bund, the most famous street in Asia during the first half of the 20th century. It was chosen by foreign powers who entered Shanghai after the Opium War of 1842 as the location for their banks, trading houses, and government buildings. Today, it is an architectural museum featuring classical European, late Renaissance, Gothic, and Art Deco styles. On the other side of the river are some of the world's tallest and most glittering skyscrapers, including the Oriental Pearl Tower, with huge globes that are meant to simulate pearls, the beautiful Jin Mao Tower, and the Shanghai World Financial Center, the tallest building in China. At night, the contrast between old and new was especially striking. The elegantly lit clock tower of the Customs House on the west was juxtaposed in the east by an orgy of light that made Broadway look amateurish. As I stood on the deck of our boat, Deng Xiaoping's description of a market economy with socialist characteristics popped into mind. I had learned from the students that while Mao is often discredited, Deng is revered as the father of modern China. In the early 1980s, he decreed that Shanghai would lead the nation into an economic revival like nothing the world had ever before witnessed. The decry worked. He also proclaimed that getting rich is glorious. The Chinese people, including Deng, still to this day are influenced by the ideas of Confucius concerning respect for hierarchy, Mandy said, when I pointed out to her that Deng's words echoed Milton Friedman's philosophy. A cool breeze floated off the river, and an oil tanker passed by, a dark shadow among the lights headed out to sea. We grow up here understanding that serving our families is the most important thing we can do. Our families extend to our communities and the nation. Deng Xiaoping should be understood in this context. It was a profound observation. If you promote the concept that making profits is the sole goal of business, or getting rich is glorious, in a culture that views the group as more important than the individual, you arrive at a wholly different interpretation of capitalism than when you apply it to a culture that emphasizes rugged individualism. The latter will look out for the greater good only when regulations mandate it, while the former will do so because the ethic is ingrained in them. Every time I asked the Chinese students about the environment, they agreed that cleaning it up was a priority. I was told again and again that it will happen. Economic growth had been the first goal. Now the time had arrived to take care of the problems that rapid development had created. During the 6 days I was in Shanghai, the government announced that it would levy taxes against polluters, support a company that was developing electric cars by making plug-in stations available around much of the country, and offer rebates of approximately $4,000 to customers who purchased those cars. When the government says it will happen, Jess told me, it will. As a consequence of the recent collapse of world markets, China's economic growth fell off to an average annual rate of increase of 6% in the first quarter of 2009, compared to the U.S. rate of decrease of 6%. Judging from the newspapers and discussions at CEIBS, the Chinese are confident they will get back on track soon, regardless of what happens elsewhere. I kept hearing that the internal market of more than 1.3 billion potential consumers has barely been tapped. In addition, many people expressed excitement over the prospects of leading the world in solar energy, wind power, electric cars, and other green products. The dean of CEIBS, Rolf Kramer, and his wife Heidi invited me to join them for dinner one evening. I figured they knew as much about the country as any foreigners, since they had first moved there from Germany more than two decades earlier. "With optimism," was Heidi's response to my question about how China will respond to global economic traumas. In many parts of the world, like Europe and the States, people complain a lot, blame others, and do little to improve things. They look for reasons not to change. Here, it's the opposite. The Chinese tell themselves why it will work and swing into action, so it does work. There is no question that capitalism has transformed China. The fact that roughly one-sixth of the world's population has turned itself so totally around in three decades signals hope for all of us. China is a land of many diverse cultures, ones that throughout history frequently fought each other. It has demonstrated the capacity we humans possess for uniting in order to realize a common cause. Rather than fearing China or criticizing its pollution levels, we can draw on its remarkable example and encourage it to do better. It will serve us well to remind ourselves that China succeeded because it did not buy into our most recent model of more debt and less regulation, nor did it take the route of so many developing nations by accepting World Bank conditionalities and structural adjustment programs, SAPs. I was asked on several occasions whether I preferred their centralized decision-making form of government, whereby policies are mandated from the top, or our more democratic one. This question inevitably was followed by an observation that the Chinese model offered the possibility that the world might pull itself back from the brink of ecological disaster, while the cumbersome nature of ours might mean that decisions could not be made fast enough to keep up with the exponential changes the world is experiencing. At first, I was indignant. It seemed a frivolous question to ask someone like me who has championed democracy. But the more I thought about it, the more I understood its very real implications, which were reinforced every time I picked up the newspaper outside my hotel room door and learned about another wall of resistance President Obama confronted when he tried to change the status quo. As I read those newspaper articles, I kept seeing examples of how democracy has been usurped in the United States. The decision-making process today is radically different from the one I studied in business school. The balance has swung from the people to the corporations. The current opposition to change in the United States is driven primarily by CEOs, their lobbyists, and the politicians who are beholden to them. The people voted in 2008 for a president who promised change, and yet now the people are sitting back, watching TV, and expecting their government to take care of all the crises. Instead, their government is still catering to the corporatocracy. So the answer to that question is that I unequivocally prefer democracy. However, I fear that our present form of government does not meet that definition. Democracy assumes an informed electorate. When a majority of the voters are kept in the dark about some of the most basic aspects of our foreign policy, the things EHM and jackals do, the lies about weapons of mass destruction, and the detention of uncharged prisoners, for example, it is difficult to claim that we are informed. I am not in a position to say whether or not the current Chinese government is responsive to the desires of the majority of its people. I can say, however, that in the United States, we have ceded many of our most basic rights to the corporations, and they have not served our best interests. They have built walls of resistance to the changes we voted for. We have done little to stop them. Democracy is not failing us. We are failing democracy. We have allowed the corporations to co-opt the democratic process. In adopting our recent form of capitalism, we have taken a government of, for, and by the people and handed it over to the corporatocracy. The solution does not require a change in our system of governance. It simply requires a revamping of the process, along with a different approach to economics. Capitalism's history is long and impressive. It encompasses many versions. We in the United States have been infected by a mutant strain. We experienced the resultant fevers, and now we have begun to commit ourselves to recovery. Like any virus, the corporatocracy is fighting back. We can take heart in the knowledge that we already have established an impressive record of victories. As discussed in the next chapter, we have forced our government and the biggest and seemingly most intransigent corporations to alter their ways. These past successes prove that we possess the tools for reining in the corporatocracy and winning back democracy. Chapter 15. David versus Goliath. Slavery was not abolished because Abraham Lincoln found himself in the White House. It ended when the people of the United States elected a president who opposed slavery. Women did not obtain the right to vote in the United States because Woodrow Wilson championed it. Women fought for suffrage over a long period of time, and once he became president, they launched a massive campaign to force him to support them. They waved banners wherever Wilson spoke, asking why Americans should die for democracy in Europe by entering World War I when half the U.S. population could not participate in the electoral process at home. The Vietnam War did not end because Richard Nixon was a pacifist. He withdrew our troops only after citizens across the land demanded an end to a conflict that appeared futile. Change has always started with us. With the patriots who threw tea into Boston Harbor in 1773, with the citizens who formed anti-slavery societies in the 1830s and anti-child labor movements in the 1840s, with the National American Woman Suffrage Association established in 1869 by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, with people who marched behind Martin Luther King Jr. and Cesar Chavez, and those who rallied with Joan Baez and Pete Seeger. Each of those movements is part of a long tradition that included the American War of Independence. We sometimes forget that the American Revolution was a rebellion against corporate abuses that were enforced by the King of England. After gaining independence, the new government granted charters only to companies that served the public interest by expanding ports, building bridges, and importing goods demanded in the marketplace. The duration of a charter was limited to as few as 10 years or until the task for which the company had been formed was completed, and no company was allowed to purchase another. This lasted for roughly 100 years until John D. Rockefeller and a few of his friends convinced New Jersey and Delaware that laws favoring wealthy investors, known as enabling acts, would generate tax revenues for their governments and kickbacks to politicians. Other states soon followed. After World War II, policies that ignored the public interest assumed global aspects as officials from the IMF and World Bank forced countries around the globe to privatize, deregulate, and borrow. Conglomerates purchased their former competitors. Their monopolistic tentacles reached to every corner of the planet. We have cycled through periods of our history when we allowed ourselves to be ruled by dictatorial powers, followed by ones where we took control. The period beginning about 1970 was a return on a global level to the earlier John D. Rockefeller robber baron cycle. A wave swept across the country and throughout much of the world that removed power from the people, this time giving it to the corporatocracy. During my 2009 trip to Shanghai, a city that has suffered many times from colonial and dictatorial governments, I was frequently haunted by images from those days. One afternoon I sat in the Yew Garden, a classical Chinese park developed under the Ming Dynasty in the 1500s. I studied the twisted, mountain-like sculpture known as the Grand Rockery that had been constructed from about 2,000 tons of rare stones fused together with rice glue. Nearly 50 feet tall, it was once the highest point in the city. Mesmerized by its peaks, ridges, ravines, and caves, removed from the bustle of the city, I experienced a sense of euphoria. Suddenly, a small boy darted past me, waving a plastic sword. Immediately, my mood shifted. I thought about the soldiers who forced thousands of slave laborers to lug those rocks to the city and chisel them into this fantasy world for emperors.